Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. John Andrus. John, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Very good to have you with us. And also good to have with us is Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing?
Yeah, well, watching the Gotterdammerung as we get booted from Washington, you know, never a dull moment.
I know. As distressing as it is for the people of South Africa and the conditions they have to live in, I must say there's quite a lot for us to talk about at the moment. The first thing, of course, as you just mentioned, is that South Africa's ambassador, Ibrahim Rasool, has been expelled from the United States. Not only did the U.S. Decide that they were no longer going to accept him as South Africa's ambassador to the U.S., but they just declared him persona non grata, which meant that he had 72 hours to leave. And I believe he's already been brought back by the South African government to SA. And we will have to send another diplomat to Washington. The reason for his expulsion was, I believe, a Breitbart article written by Joel Pollack, as far as I can tell. And it reported comments that Rasool made while addressing the Makhumgubwe Institute for Strategic Reflection. Rasool was speaking to them. I'm not quite sure when the talk took place. I think it was very recent. I think it was in the last week. He was speaking to the Makhumgubwe Institute, and he said, in short, that Trump's disrespect for the current hegemonic world order was being driven by a sort of white supremacism, and that he was leading a kind of global white supremacist movement. There's a whole paragraph here of his comments that are quite wordy, so I'm not gonna quote them all. But I think that's a relatively fair assessment. He then actually kind of agreed with Trump's pushing back on global institutions, saying that South Africa could encourage Trump's, quote, healthy disrespect for global institutions, that South Africa feels are dominated by the West anyway, and said that Trump's stance was like being a broken clock, being right twice a day. But he also said that South Africa could lead the pushback to Trump's white supremacism, saying the country was the historical antidote to supremacism. He also said that South Africa didn't have the ability to play the U.S. and China off against each other, since trade with the U.S. was in manufactured goods and trade with China was in commodities, and therefore we kind of needed both. It was an interesting observation, although I don't entirely know if I agree with it. But anyway, once this became sort of public knowledge and went out on social media, Secretary of State Marco Rubio kind of linked to this article and said, South Africa's ambassador to the United States is no longer welcome in our great country. Ibrahim Rasool is a race-baiting politician who hates America and hates the president of the United States. We have nothing to discuss with him, and so he's considered persona non grata. And shortly after that social media post, it was followed up with his expulsion. President Cyril Ramaphosa has kind of downplayed this all, saying that he's not deterred or discouraged by the recent tensions between South Africa and the U.S. He says that the historical relationship will, quote, outlive the current bumpy patch. His spokesperson, Vincent Mangwenya, said that South Africa will continue to constructively engage with the U.S. despite challenges, quote, our commitment to maintaining mutually beneficial relations within the strategic context of our bilateral diplomatic and trade relationship remains unwavering. The spokesperson for the presidency said that Rasool's expulsion was regrettable. There are lessons to be drawn from the experience, and we will reflect on those lessons. Terence, what lessons are to be drawn from the expulsion of our ambassador to the United States?
Well, there's short and long-term ones. But I would say that if the South African state is going to learn a lesson, it would be a truly novel experience. Okay, the short-term one is this, that the ambassador of a country, top tip everyone, does not go and insult the head of state in a public forum. You know, it's a funny thing about the internet. Now, I'm of a certain age. I grew up without it. But that, you know, you can say things right here in Johannesburg and people can actually see you doing that in New York. It's the most amazing technology. And I don't know, you know, maybe you just lost sight of that. And simply because the webinar was being hosted in South Africa did not mean that people in America were not going to find out, especially when you're going to say such incendiary things. Ambassador Rasool has previously talked about putting the megaphone down, which he seems to do long enough to, you know, catch his breath to pick it up again. So, yeah, you know, don't do that, folks. But there's a deeper level here, and this actually connects the piece that I wrote today about the state of Johannesburg, the basic systems failure of governance. South Africa has been using its diplomatic corps as a escape hatch for used up politicians to get, you know, to deal with factional interests in the ANC. I'm not sure how many career professional ambassadors we have, and how many of them have not simply been elevated from some sort of party political position. And I think as with the state of Johannesburg, as with, you know, the state of Mpumalanga, with the state of Eskom or Transnet, the state of our diplomatic corps is just dire. It's simply not up to it's not fit for purpose. I would say that Ambassador Rasool was probably never was, and particularly not when there's a combative interlocutor in his post country. So yeah, you know, you can keep on doing the same thing again and again, and maybe people don't get expelled. But South Africa's standing, its ability to even articulate its interests will decline. Look, remember about 3 years ago, you had the ambassador to Denmark, I think the late Zinzi Mandela, I believe, who was tweeting about, you know, how she's whining and dining here, disappeared, you know, swearing on Twitter, as it was at that point. And I remember actually being called into an interview on one of the TV stations, and I thought, well, it's an interesting topic to talk about, diplomacy and the way we conduct it. And all they wanted to talk about was, shouldn't we have a better social media policy? You know, this is a whole of society failing that we've learned to see things in a very parochial, very it's always about us sense of things. Not questioning the, you know, many of those foundational assumptions. And I think until we do, this simply will be a hyperbolic, but I think a not atypical situation. Yeah, just small anecdote before you move on, if I may. In 2009, I was invited to speak at a conference in Germany put on by the Hans Seidel Foundation. Now, in an audience in Munich, attended by representatives of some of the big investors in South Africa, companies like BMW, a representative from the local consulate said, there's too much inequality in South Africa. We have to abolish property rights and start seizing things. She left me in the unenviable position of trying to point out this is not actually government policy.
Oh, dear. I guess the first thought I have on this is that this was, above all else, actually just self-indulgent by the now former ambassador. You know, when you go to another country, you have to represent the country. And if you're going to criticize that country, it must be in accordance with the official policy and strategy of the country that you are representing. You can't just, like, you know, go off and, like, you know, if we invited Ambassador Rasool on the Daily Friend show and then just asked him to riff on US politics, he would be doing a great disservice. And I think it's no surprise then that he's landed himself in this hot water. So just completely avoidable, just silly, stupid mistake, particularly at such a time as this, when the US is very much looking for a fight with the ANC and South Africa at large. I guess my other question, John, is, and it, I think Ramaphosa has already kind of given us the answer here, is that it doesn't look like, often when this sort of thing happens between countries, they expel each other's diplomats. Now, what makes it a little bit complicated is the U.S. has not appointed a diplomat yet. Reuben Brighty, who was the Biden-appointed diplomat, resigned just before Trump came into office, which is fairly normal for political appointees. And there's now a sort of career non-partisan bureaucrat who's the interim ambassador until such a time as they appoint a new one. There's been sort of rumors in the media and social media space that Joel Pollack is you know, the person who wrote this Breitbart article would be the Trump administration's pick for an ambassador. And I wonder, do you think there's any chance that South Africa would retaliate by kicking him out or refusing to accept him as ambassador if he gets appointed? I don't know, John. What do you think of this?
Good question. So, effectively, yes. I do think that there's a scope and appetite for tit for tat diplomacy. You know, so you kick our guy out, we'll kick yours out. But on the other hand, it also seems that the ANC is in a sort of defensive posture at the moment and unsettled, uncertain, and might actually not do that. And I think they're very much thinking about trying to figure out what's going on and why is it going so wrong and why are the efforts, cack-handed as they may be, unsuccessful. And it's like, can't quite figure out what's going on. And I thought that there was a piece, a sort of a short post by James Myburg on the topic recently, where he wrote that South Africa's policy communication can be seen as happening on two frequencies, channel one and channel two. And he says channel one is for domestic audiences, like for South Africans, the communication is about, you know, race-based policies are fine, challenging property rights is fine, calling to kill the Boer, kill the farmer, fine. That's like, all of that is fine. And then on channel two, which is for international audiences, that's where it's all about respectability. So it'll be like, you know, there's no greater defender of human rights than the South African government in the entire world. We are the champions of reconciliation. We are the champions of kindness, of empathy, of friendliness, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what's happening at the moment, what the Trump administration is doing, is that it's sort of just completely switching off channel two, which is the veil, and listening in on channel one, which is the domestic communication, and focusing on that, and being appropriately shocked at what's going on in South Africa. And so when people ask, what can South Africa do to fix this? Effectively, I think there's no channel two solution to this.
And
he's okay. Back.
Yeah, there you go.
Sorry. Okay, so I'm saying there's no channel two solution to this. In other words, you can't appoint like the right diplomat or find the right delegation of envoys to talk to the Americans because they're not listening on channel two anymore. They're listening on channel one. So if you want to solve the problem, you have to solve it on the channel one level. That means you've got to get your own house in order, which means you've got to get South Africa right. You've got to introduce the reforms that are going to make this place successful. And I think as a successful country, one where the economy is growing, that's attracting investment, that's keeping its citizens safe, then we become a serious partner and a serious prospect for the United States again. And for as long as we fail to do that, all diplomacy, messaging, explaining, justifying, picking different candidates is not going to work. It's going to be futile. Nick?
So, Terence, we were actually discussing this a little bit before the show started. Firstly, what's your solution for what the ANC should do in the very short term? I agree with John, obviously, that they should, you know, change our policy so that it actually encourages growth and economy and the economics. But, you know, what should they do in the very short term in response to this? Who should they be sent as our next ambassador, I guess, is the question.
Look,
is there any prospect of a GOA being renewed for South Africa?
Okay, I think AGOA is gone. I think AGOA as a whole, as a program, may be abolished. It doesn't seem to be the kind of thing that Trump has any appetite for. And I think that on various levels, South Africa never really qualified for it. And we just have a very unsympathetic interlocutor in America now. So I think that is gone. I think that the real risk, though, is do we get hit by more tariffs that impact on more of our trade. Also, given the fact that South Africa is not a competitive country to do business in. I mean, if it costs you all this money just to get your stuff to your port. okay, what should South Africa do? I think, first of all, to realize that we've been playing things very, very badly. I don't think necessarily that, you know, some of these things would have, you know, like the ICJ case would have produced the kind of rupture it has. If South Africa was offering something different, was offering a different value proposition. So, you know, if there was a domestic constituency that was very attached to South Africa and was lobbying on South Africa's behalf, if South Africa was a China-sized economy that you couldn't ignore, you know, those sort of things would would count. South Africa, I think, has, as the Afrikaans saying goes, found itself on a long slapperie, just out of its depth, exposed itself, and, you know, said, oh, BRICS is the solution, and then discovered, oh, well, you know, the Indians and the Brazilians are going to do Belt and Road, and the Russians are bigger fish to fry, and the Chinese, well, show us the money first. You know, this is Zimbabwe also thought they could appeal to the Chinese. Chinese turned around and said, sort your internals out, make nice with the IMF, and then you can come talk to us. Yeah. I would say, though, that two immediate priorities, actually getting a function, getting an American embassy that you can talk to. And I think it's not so much South Africa refusing to accept the American ambassador, although I think that someone like Joel Pollack may be seen as, you know, unacceptable to South Africa. But I think if South Africa says, no, they won't accept him, then I just think we don't get anything. Now, I think the worst thing that happens is we don't get an ambassador at all. We just sort of get left in stasis. So there's hardly anyone you can talk to. And secondly, I think send someone to America who is not politically compromised. I would say, and I'm very, very skeptical about the role of business and politics. Don't think businessmen make good politicians. But I think that you could do worse than finding somebody who has some who has a business successful business career and who has a lot of dealings with America, who can perhaps go and speak in those transactional terms. About three things: trade, tourism, investment. Nothing else. We're not going to change the world. We're not going to get a friendlier relationship with America. That is gone for the moment. And the ANC must, I think, accept that it's been working towards this. I mean, you're going to go and explain. What are you going to go and explain? You're going to go and explain how your documents talk about, you know, America as the sort of great Satan, although, like, not quite using that language, but, you know, they're responsible for everything.
It's even more than that. I mean, Rasul was sort of talking about, no, we must encourage Trump's breaking of global institutions so that we can, like, destroy Western dominance.
Well,
what the hell are we trying to do? Like, is South Africa, does he think South Africa is some major world player that is able to just sort of shape global institutions to its will? I mean, I'd like to live in that world, but we don't.
Careful of that. Because South Africa at the moment is getting, I think, a better than expected reception from the Europeans. They are very, you know, committed to those sort of arrangements. So if South Africa wants to burn both bridges, but we also want all that stuff destroyed. Ha, you know.
Exactly. Okay.
Nicholas, before you move on.
Go ahead.
Can I use this gap to just talk about the IRR's What SA Can Be campaign quickly?
Of course. I should have done that already, but go ahead.
Because it ties into this, right? So the IRR launches a campaign today where we sort of articulate some basic points to make South Africa a successful country in the next 10 years, 15 years. These are the very same points that will make the relationship with the United States successful, as well as the relationship with China. It is what will turn South Africa into a successful and effective nation. So if you're watching this, visit our website, go look for What SA Can Be, check out the pledge, and if you agree with it, feel free to sign up. But this is what we're pushing for this country: to protect property rights, to adopt non-racial policies, to allow choice in education and healthcare, to aim for high economic growth, and to become an effective and successful country. Thank you, Nicholas.
No, exactly. We believe that the things that we advocate for, often daily on this podcast, are the things that will uplift the lives of almost every single South African. Maybe some connected businessmen will suffer under our policies, but everyone from the poor to the well-meaning businessmen and everything in between will have a good time, I think. All right. Speaking of bad policies and businessmen not being wise, let's talk a little bit about Group CEO Sim Tshabalala from Standard Bank, who announced at a conference recently that Standard Bank wasn't too worried about the Expropriation Act that has been signed into law by President Ramaphosa recently. He said that Standard Bank had conducted an analysis of the Expropriation Act and has found that it's not that big a deal, that it wouldn't change the banking giant's lending policy or risk appetite. Quote, this analysis includes a consideration of the state of property rights in South Africa, the risk that they might deteriorate, and the possible causes and consequences of that hypothetical deterioration. In the context of South Africa's gold standard constitution and Bill of Rights and our deeply entrenched rule of law, we've concluded that the Expropriation Act of 2024 does not weaken property rights in South Africa, nor does it weaken the sanctity of contract. This was a report that Standard Bank hired workmen's attorneys to compile. Any hypothetical expropriation with or without compensation will be subject to judicial review on grounds including constitutionality, rationality, fairness, and public interest. In summary, on land expropriation, it is reasonable to conclude the new Expropriation Act does not warrant any modification to our lending policy or risk appetite. He went on to say about the U.S.'s deteriorating relationship with South Africa that he thought this wasn't a big deal either, that the heightened rhetoric and souring of relations between South Africa and the USA, there was no evidence of a reduction in economic activity between the two countries, saying that trade flow remained uninterrupted and U.S. businesses with a presence in South Africa continued to operate. Quote, we bank a large number of American corporations operating in South Africa and the African continent. They include all major names you can think of. We know there are about 600 American corporations in South Africa, and they employ a large number of people. Those companies will continue to do business. We will continue to facilitate their payments, whether it be payroll, borrowings, transactions, or hedgings, or so forth. John, why are you such a fear-mongering lunatic who's trying to drive the conversation into the ground?
Oh, because I care about our rate of fixed investment. So, you know, our fixed investment rate is 15%. That's probably the most important number in South Africa. Global average is 26. Our internal target is 30 as a country. And many emerging markets are above 30, like 35% of fixed investment being put into roads, bridges, factories, machinery, et cetera, et cetera. So we've got a problem with fixed investment. And one of the reasons for that is that property rights are not as well respected as they should be in South Africa. And the Expropriation Act, in our view, very much represents a further undermining of property rights. What Standard Bank is doing here and Worksmen's Attorneys as well is running interference for the government and trying to pacify investors and make them feel safe so that they keep putting their money into South Africa. But whether that is in the best interest of the investors is the question, because if expropriation does get abused or take off or be used in the prescribed manner, which can be quite harmful, if you get expropriated for less than market value or if it's land for zero, then those investors are going to get burnt. So this is doing a disservice to the investors. I think that the risks are not being taken seriously enough by the bank. It would be a good challenge to the bank to ask it to issue guarantees for any shortfalls in compensation to be made up by the bank. In other words, if your house gets expropriated, you still owe money to Standard Bank on that house and your compensation is less than market value, then Standard Bank should cover the shortfall for you to repay that loan. And that would be putting your skin in the game and showing that you really do believe that expropriation is not a risk to property in South Africa. Nick?
You know, this kind of attitude from big business always irritates me very much, because one immediately begins to sort of retreat, at least in my mind, into kind of not, I think, entirely unfounded conspiracy theory that maybe they're not so worried because they think they can cut some sort of special exemption. You know, this is particularly, I think, seen in big business. You know, when he describes the deeply entrenched rule of law, I mean, South Africa is a country where, you know, we know that prosecutions often seem to not go forward when they are politically connected persons, which is a, you know, big part of the rule of law. Ministers often have extraordinary discretionary powers to mess around with regulations and to basically almost legislate by decree, which is also very counter to the rule of law. There's problems with courts and getting the police to do things and bring cases. And this is not a country with deeply entrenched rule of law. It's one of the big problems is that we're, you know, we do have the rule of law. I guess we've got more than, you know, Somalia, but like, this is not a high bar to climb. So Terence, what do you make of these comments and that the expropriation bill is, you know, not a great threat?
Our former CEO, John Kane Berman, once said, South African business has never met a government it doesn't like. You know, We don't have a tradition. We with a few exceptions, we don't have a tradition one way or the other of activist business. And that's interesting because South Africa is also a global pioneer in corporate governance, which emphasizes things like your responsibility to the community as opposed to just your profit margin and whatever. I also remember that the chairman of the Banking Council a couple of years ago, I think their appeal to government was, well, if you introduce this law, and this was the law they were talking about, and you're taking things with, at less than market value. And remember, it doesn't have to be nil compensation for you to be expropriated without compensation. It just has to be less than its value, in which case you're taking a portion without compensation, just so we know. And his appeal was, well, we want guarantees that we won't be adversely affected. So we want our interests secured. As far as our clients go, well, they might be out of luck. In a way, I do. I have an iota of understanding, if not sympathy, because it's a highly regulated sector, and you could fight. Just like Trump can make it very difficult for South Africa, the South African government can make it very difficult for the banks through its regulatory powers. So, but this is something that I do think that there is no danger until the danger is there. And we made plenty of suggestions for how this for how this could be mitigated. We sought meetings with banking institutions, some of which I went to. It's not like they haven't been warned.
Final thoughts, John.
Yeah, agree with what Terence is saying there. But also, I think, even if the Expropriation Act doesn't get scrapped, the fact that pressure is being applied to prevent it being abused is helpful. So if we imagine the hypothetical case where Standard Bank were to say, yes, we will compensate our clients if they have a shortfall because compensation is less than market value, I think that would also serve as a deterrent to the government to use this power, because then they'd have Standard Bank on their case saying, what are you doing?
Oh dear.
Yes,
We
he's
see.
back.
He'll be
So
back. There you
Standard Bank, exactly. So it would serve as a deterrent, because if the government were to start expropriating and Standard Bank would have to cover for those losses, Standard Bank would be in the president's office, one hopes, saying, this is not wise. We do not approve of it. Please cease and desist forthwith. So I think this kind of campaign is quite important.
No, exactly. All right, let's move on to our last story. And this is actually kind of a little bit related to the two previous ones we've talked about. And this is from reporting in City Press and Rapport over the weekend, which said that the ANC was perhaps not being entirely honest with its description of the DA's demands relating to the budget. The ANC has in recent days really fired up the sort of racial rhetoric, which had been, I think, put on the back burner since the formation of the GNU about the DA. Fikile Mbalula implied that the DA wanted to go back to, quote, the good old days of apartheid, the DA's efforts were being driven by their constituency, which is in the context very obviously meant to, I don't know, white people or minorities or whatever sort of disapproved of group the ANC was talking about in that context. There's been just lots of attacks and claims that the DA would only agree to the VAT if it could change all these policies, NHI, Bella, whatever, whatever. But the reporting in the media suggests that the DA actually had a much more modest proposal that it sent to the ANC with regards to the VAT increase in the budget. They said they would support the budget under the following conditions. A tender process is established within a year by which the powers of Cape Town and Richards Bay ports can be decentralized. The Expropriation Act is amended so that a court has the final say from the outset of the expropriation of the property in question and not the state, as is the case with the current legislation, which has the power to expropriate property pending a court application. It's another reason why the Standard Bank downplaying this is you know, silly. An offer from the World Bank is accepted to conduct a regulatory review of the state. A strategy for the decentralization of passenger trains is developed and adopted by the end of the year. A committee is set up to carry out a comprehensive spending review, which must reprioritize $100 billion in spending by the end of the year at national and provincial government levels, and a focus on reprioritization of the state spending is undertaken to reduce South Africa's debt burden. Then the two deputy finance ministers, David Masondo and Ashwell Sirapan, would lead the committee into reviewing spending, which Gorongwana would approve, would give to cabinet for approval. Regarding the 100 billion rand, the DA says is could be reprioritized. 30% of the money should be used to clear South Africa's debt burden. 20% would be used to reduce personal income tax for bottom income bands, and 50% should go towards infrastructure spending. And the DA said that this plan would demonstrate that the GNU was a responsible government and that a compromise had been reached and that was all good and well. These proposals appear to have been completely rejected by the ANC, with a couple of small caveats that they said they would have a audit of ghost workers in government. But that seems to have been like the only concession, really, that the ANC accepted into the budget that they proposed. So, John, you know, it looks like the DA went in with, considering the situation, I think a relatively modest proposal, and the ANC told them to stuff it. So what is the ANC strategy going forward? Because it doesn't look like they've really got one.
Yeah, that's really weird. And I agree, it's a pretty modest ask. Should not have been too hard for the ANC to say yes to that, especially because they were getting the DA to commit to tax increases, which is, like, you know, politically a tough sell.
And VAT too, the worst. Yeah,
exactly. So this actually looked like a pretty good deal for the ANC. So it's somewhat surprising that they rejected it. And of course, the downstream consequences might turn out to be far more expensive for the ANC than accepting that deal would have been. If you think of what they'll have to do now to get a majority of votes to pass the various pieces of legislation that go into passing the budget, are they still going to get those for the DA? Is that price going to rise? Will they get them from some smaller parties or from, you know, the EFF or MK? And what price are they going to pay to do that? It's a bit of a corner that the ANC has backed itself into.
Terence, your thoughts?
Well, look, as for the votes and everything, and the final form that the budget takes when it's adopted, as the saying goes, it ain't over till it's over. And I think we could still see some surprising things happening. But yeah, look, I think fundamentally the ANC still has not crossed the big emotional Rubicon, that it's not entirely it's not the sole power, and I think that it's approached this whole arrangement rather like it would by, you know, inviting one or two representatives of minor parties in on its own sufferance. You know, they did that with the IFP. They did that with the Freedom Front Plus. They did that with Patricia de Lille. We just aren't in that space anymore. I suspect also that Mr. Gorongwana must be experiencing a great deal of stress, because he gets to look at those numbers. They're not abstract to him, and I do believe that if anyone in cabinet understands the depth of South Africa's crisis, it's him. And my heart actually does go out to him. I think he's generally, you know, an honorable man who wants to do the right thing. But yeah, you know,
he sort of took sole responsibility for the proposal of the VAT increase, which I thought was sort of politically brave in a way. But yeah, no, I must say that I don't quite share the sympathy. I think that he is the ANC in general is being very sort of pig-headed on this issue, and it's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see how it works out for them, to quote the great movie Dodgeball. Any final thoughts, John?
No, maybe except just to be prepared for this to be a potential crisis moment in the development of the country. So we might find ourselves within the next 3 or 4 months on a different track. And one track would be where the ANC sort of embraces the DA and reforms, maybe. And the other track is where it outright rejects the DA and seeks its solace and its comfort in the arms of the more radical parties. It looks like that choice might have to be made soon.
Possibly, although I think one shouldn't downplay the possibility that the ANC will simply try to limp on with last year's budget and the severe spending constraints while endlessly arguing with all potential deals as being not quite right. So it's sort of dysfunctional status quo, I think, is also on the cards possibly. But yeah, exactly. I think this is a very important moment in our politics. So we'll have to see. Anyway, thank you very much, everyone, for listening. And we hope that you found the show interesting. Please go do check out our Be Part of What SA Can Be campaign. And we will see you all tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.